Welcome to this 19th edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 9th chapter, part 2, which is titled Cosmos. There have been several extinctions. The one wiping out the dinosaurs is the most famous. David M. Raup has estimated species loss in the Permo-Triassic extinction, the granddaddy of all, at 96%. When diversity plummets to 4% of its former value, we must entertain the idea that some groups lose by something akin to sheer bad luck. Stephen Gould previously cited, page 306. Bad luck? Maybe. But in light of the above, where children of God learn to be creators and experiment with life, I might speculate that the pre-mortal existent spirits of these animals had simply run out. There were no more shellfish or brachiopods of these particular types to come to Earth, at least in the current round of life creation. Besides, it was time to make way for more advanced species and let them have their turns. Either that, or the animal spirits, like a woman shopping for clothes, tried on the proposed bodies, decided they didn't fit, and returned them for something more suitable. A back-to-the-drawing-board rate of 90-plus percent may be frustrating, but this is life, and it's something these creatures are going to have to live with forever, so it must be gotten right for them. As stated earlier, God is the God of all life, and he's not going to shortchange any of his creations. Carl Zimmer, Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea, previously cited, quotes a couple of biologists who are also committed Christians and have no trouble combining the two ideologies. Kenneth Miller, a biochemist at Brown University, observes, quote, that the mutations that make evolution possible take place on a quantum level, and as a result, we can never know with perfect certainty whether a particular mutation will take place. When a cosmic ray whistles into the inner sanctum of a cell's nucleus and collides with DNA, it may or may not transform one of the bases. A God who presides over an evolutionary process is not an impotent, passive observer. Rather, he is one whose genius fashioned a fruitful world, in which the process of continuing creation is woven into the fabric of matter itself. End quote. Page 338. As to the dinosaurs, they were successful for 100 million years and could have been for 60 million more up to our time, but for that damned asteroid, at least from their point of view. Gould phrases it thus, quote, since dinosaurs were not moving toward markedly larger brains, and since such a prospect may lie outside the capabilities of reptilian design, we must assume that consciousness would not have evolved on our planet if a cosmic catastrophe had not claimed the dinosaurs as victims. In an entirely literal sense, we owe our existence as large and reasoning mammals to our lucky stars. Previously cited, page 318. If we are allowed to experiment with DNA and cosmic rays to bring about evolutionary mutations, why not asteroids to bring to an end one era of life and set the stage for another? In Old Testament and Related Studies, Professor Nibley, previously cited, expresses the opinion that rather than gradual development, evolution or life progresses by leaps and bounds. Quote, one of the most militant evolutionists of our day says that it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families, and nearly all categories above the level of families, appear in the record suddenly and are not led up to by known gradual, completely continuous transitional sequences. Page 29. Nibley is quoting George Gaylord Simpson from a 1953 textbook. This has become a template for expression of evolutionary processes with Stephen Gould's and Niles Eldridge's punctuated equilibrium theory. In his words from Time's Arrow, Time's Cycle, page 133, quote, in most cases, fully marine strata lie directly atop terrestrial beds with no signs of smooth transition. The world of dinosaurs does not yield gradually to the realm of mammals. Instead, dinosaurs disappear from the record in apparent concert with about half the species of marine organisms in one of the five major mass extinctions of life's history. Faunal transitions, read literally, are almost always abrupt, both from species to species and from biota to biota, end quote. Lewis Thomas writes of, quote, billions of my embryonic cells being killed off systematically to make room for their more senior successors, death on a scale so vast that I can't think of it without wincing. By the time I was born, more of me had died than survived. It is no wonder I can't remember. During that time, I went through brain after brain for 9 months, finally contriving the one model that could be human, equipped for language. That comes from A Long Line of Cells, page Roman numeral 10. In other words, the fetus in the normal course of development builds, then destroys structures as it goes to make way for the more advanced and final structures that will make it a human being. Is this process mimicking evolution? Looks like it to me. Maybe evolution is more than just a process used to create life forms. Maybe it's a standard procedure and path that all life has to take, even when the eventual and final body has already been figured out. But all this experimentation, all the assumed waste of materials and effort, are pencils and crayons wasted in first grade as children learn to draw and write? No, that's what they're for. Anyway, as we mentioned earlier, the materials are recycled, so there's no real waste. The only thing wasted is effort, and that goes to our education. Philosopher Eric Hoffer has just the right words to express what's going on here, though he probably didn't intend them for such usage. Quote, finally, a society needs a large measure of affluence before it can allow its members the full play of their initiative and bents. It must be able to afford the waste inherent in a riot of trial and error. There can be no real freedom without the freedom to change, to fail. As from his book, The Ordeal of Change, page 98. These elements come together wonderfully for a glimpse of the cosmos. Affluence, well, we're dealing with the entire universe, and a father to whom these things can be made up seemingly at will. The freedom to fail, this book devotes a whole chapter and several other observations to the sacredness of the idea of freedom. We have, therefore, the means and the milieu to develop our initiatives and bents. Let's go on with it, then. Let's jump into this riot of trial and error, knowing full well that's what our Father has set up for us. Seriously, look at this. Doesn't it seem that the cosmos may be a hell of a lot more fun than we usually think it is? And creating a universe from a Big Bang isn't that difficult. If I remember correctly from my reading, and sorry I can't give an exact quote on this, here's the formula. Take one wastebasket full of dirt, about 25 pounds, and compress it into a space less than the diameter of an electron. When the pressure is released, the resultant bang will be a Big Bang, and a new universe is underway. Of course, that's the hard part, compressing all that dirt into such a tiny space. But anyone who has repacked a suitcase after a 2-week vacation should have no trouble with this. Bah! Sorry. For a finishing touch and summation of the creation process, let me quote Professor Nibley, Old Testament and Related Studies, as he interprets an LDS scripture known as the Pearl of Great Price, which deals with the records of both Moses and Abraham regarding the creation. I'll just skip quote through pages 69 through 74. Quote, the creation process, as described in the Pearl of Great Price, is open-ended and ongoing, entailing a careful planning based on vast experience, long consultations, models, tests, and even trial runs for a complicated system requiring a vast scale of participation by the creatures concerned. The whole operation is dominated by the overriding principle of love. The gods ordered, saying, "Let such and such happen," and it was so even as they ordered. What they ordered was not the completed product, but the process to bring it about, providing a scheme under which life might expand. Quote, "Let us prepare the earth to bring forth grass," not "let us create grass." "Let us prepare the waters to bring forth abundantly." And the gods prepared the waters that they might bring forth great whales and every living creature that moveth. The waters are so treated that they will have the capacity, like setting up a saltwater aquarium before adding fish. The gods did not make whales on the spot, but arranged it so that in time they might appear. They created the potential. Quote, "And the gods watched those things which they had ordered until they obeyed." They obeyed is the active voice. It is the principle of maximum participation, of the active cooperation of all of God's creatures in the working out of his plans, which in fact are devised for their benefit. Everybody gets into the act. Every creature, to the limit of its competence, is given the supreme compliment of being left on its own, so that the word obey is correctly applied. What he commands is what will best fulfill the measure of their existence, but they are not forced to it. They are not automata. And how long did it take? That question is unanswerable, for all of this was after the Lord's time, not ours. The gods had not appointed unto Adam his reckoning. Until then, time is measured from their point of view, not ours. As far as we are concerned, it can be any time. Theirs was a different time. The periods are numbered, but never measured. In moving from one system to another, one also changes one's timing. The gods watched those things which they had ordered until they obeyed. That important word, until, tells us two things. One, that they took all the time that was necessary, no matter how long it might have been, measuring the period in terms not of a terminal date, but in terms of the requirements of the task. Two, until means up till a certain time, but not thereafter. Let me address in a paragraph here one of the objections to creation versus chance evolution. It is brought up that since the stars were caused to shine only after two creative periods, and since the earth is way younger than the stars that are shining, then something doesn't line up right with creationism. Genesis 1, 14-17. Well, consider the famous Buddhist koan. If a tree falls in the forest and there's no one to hear it, does it make a sound? Now let's ask, if a star shines in the sky and there's no life form to perceive its light, is it shining? The earth had been well established for at least a couple billion years before animals with primitive eye spots could discern light from dark, and that at the beginning only of the sun and perhaps moon. Sure, stars were shining well before even the creation of our solar system, but with no life forms to take note of them, they might as well have not been shining at all, or at least as far as we're concerned. Okay, settled with that? Now, by the way, Francis Collins in The Language of God notes, the Hebrew word used in Genesis 1 for day can be used both to describe a 24-hour day and to describe a more symbolic representation. Just as we might say, in my grandfather's day, without implying that grandpa lived only 24 hours, page 152. Further, a time will come when time will be no more. Quote, that there should be time no longer. Revelations 10, verse 6. New Testament. I think also that time is a temporary condition, a tool God uses for his purposes in advancing us. We need it here on earth because otherwise we'd just fiddle fart our existence away, knowing there'd never be an accounting. there has to be a point where God blows his whistle and demands, okay, time's up, everybody out of the pool. It isn't just plant, animal, and human life that requires such strenuous effort at creation. In Parallel Worlds, physicist Michio Kaku devotes 15 pages, a whole chapter, to how Earth is in the Goldilocks zone to be a home for life, and how the entire material universe itself is in that same zone. So, in my interpretation, it could become the cosmos. Chapter 8, beginning on page 241, titled A Designer Universe. A Goldilocks zone is named for the fairy tale girl who found one bowl of porridge too hot, the next too cold, but the third was just right. Same for softness of beds, etc., as she sneaked around uninvited in the home of the three bears. I'll skip quote through Kaku to give you an idea. We all know how if Earth was closer to the sun, its oceans would boil off and life would be impossible. If it were farther, then the seas would be frozen, and again, no life would exist. That's just the beginning. Quote, if Earth were a bit smaller, its gravity would be so weak that it could not keep its oxygen. Consider, for example, Mars. If it were too large, it would retain many of its primordial poisonous gases, making life impossible. Earth has just the right mass to keep an atmospheric composition beneficial to life. Page 243. Quote, if the moon were much smaller, even a tiny perturbations in Earth's spin would slowly accumulate over hundreds of millions of years, causing Earth to wobble disastrously and creating drastic changes in the climate so as to make life impossible. Page 242. Since it takes hundreds of millions of years of climatic stability to foster the development of DNA, a smaller moon, one which couldn't hold the wobble of Earth to a steady and smaller scale, would have made for a lifeless planet. Earth's wobble, as you know, is what gives us our seasons. Mars, with smaller moons, has no control on its wobble, and as a result goes through eras of instability, which astronomers now observe are beginning again. Jupiter also plays a role. Quote, its immense gravity helps to fling asteroids into outer space. If Jupiter were much smaller and its gravity much weaker, then our solar system would still be full of asteroids, making life on Earth impossible. Page 243. We all know what the asteroid did to the dinosaurs. The fact that Jupiter and the other gas giants orbit in a nearly circular plane instead of erratic ellipses like comets that bring them in close to the sun, then far away, augurs for life. If their orbits were erratic, then they'd disrupt Earth's orbit and maybe even crash into us or draw us away from the sun. In fact, eccentric orbits are the rule rather than the exception in the galaxy, at least as far as our astronomers can tell. Quote, highly eccentric orbits are common in space, so common in fact that when a normal solar system was discovered in space with circular rather than egg-shaped orbits, it made headlines in 2003. It isn't just our orbit around the sun. Quote, Earth also exists within the Goldilocks zone of the Milky Way galaxy, about two-thirds of the way from the center. If the solar system were too close to the galactic center, where a black hole lurks, the radiation field would be so intense that life would be impossible. And if the solar system were too far away, there would not be enough higher elements to create the necessary elements of life. Page 244. Kaku notes there are scores of examples of how Earth is just right. From the amount of oceans, plate tectonics, oxygen content, heat content, tilt of its axis, and so on. That's on the macro level. Now let's consider the micro level. Quote, start with the way atoms are made, with the fact that a proton weighs slightly less than a neutron. If the proton were just 1% heavier, it would decay into a neutron, and all nuclei would become unstable and disintegrate. Atoms would fly apart, making life impossible. page 246. He goes into a bit of detail on such things as the strong nuclear force and the weak force. To conclude, scientists have in fact assembled long lists of scores of such happy cosmic accidents. When faced with this imposing list, it's shocking to find how many of the familiar constants of the universe lie within a very narrow band that makes life possible. If a single one of these accidents were altered, stars would never form, the universe would fly apart, DNA would not exist, life as we know it would be impossible, Earth would flip over or freeze, and so on, page 247. Sir Martin Rees of Cambridge University and the Astronomer Royal of England considers the two ideas of chance evolution of the universe and a universe guided by a divine source, and states, "I once thought so, as to the universe being a matter of evolutionary coincidence and chance and luck, but that view now seems too narrow. Once we accept this, various apparently special features of our universe, those that some theologians once adduced as evidence for providence or design, occasion no surprise." Page 249. Rees claims that the universe seems to be governed by six numbers, each of which is measurable and finely tuned. These six numbers must satisfy the conditions for life, or else they create dead universes. Page 250. Paul Davies, God and the New Physics, previously cited, seems to agree, quote, "If the Big Bang was just a random event, then the probability seems overwhelming, a colossal understatement. To find an ordered universe, the Creator would have to scour a selection of models that is so vast its number could not be written down on a sheet of paper as big as the entire observable universe," end quote. Page 168. He gives a number of years for a random universe to pop up at 10 to the 10th power to the 80th power. "Besides some of the leftovers in the back of my refrigerator, nothing in the cosmos is that old." The best summation of all this is Kaku's quote, "Astronomer Hugh Ross, to emphasize how truly remarkable this situation is, has compared it to a Boeing 747 aircraft being completely assembled as a result of a tornado striking a junkyard." Page 247. "I suppose if we took a trillion trillions of tornadoes and junkyards, one might eventually find something resembling a Boeing 747. But would you want to get in it and try to fly it? But who collects the junkyard? Who starts the tornado?" I think Sir Martin Rees has it right. That view now seems too narrow. Is infinity really infinite? At which point does it become ridiculous to assume that out of several hundred trillion chances, one of them will pay off? Only a complete fool would buy a lottery ticket under those odds. I think there comes a point where we have to draw the line and say, okay, sure, we can stretch these numbers on out to infinity, but doesn't it get ridiculous after a certain point? And we have to give up on the idea that chance and coincidence, like Sir Martin Rees, admit the possibility of intelligent creation. Example, quote, "There exists a cure for any infectious disease, and there exists a Latin formula which, if pronounced in proper ritual manner, cures all diseases," end quote. This theory can be tested by taking all the Latin vocabulary, rearranging them in combinations, and pronouncing them with varying inflections over the bed of a sick and dying man. But you'd have to have infinite time to do all that, and the poor invalid doesn't have that luxury. Karl Popper, previously cited, says of this, "Here we have an empirically irrefutable statement that few of us would hold to be true. The statement is irrefutable because it is obviously impossible to try out every conceivable Latin formula in combination with every conceivable manner of pronouncing it. Thus, there always remains the logical possibility that there might be, after all, a magical Latin formula with the power of curing all diseases. Even so, we are justified in believing that this irrefutable existential statement is false. The conjecture that there is no such magical Latin formula is much more reasonable than the irrefutable conjecture that such a formula does exist. Page 196. I would say the same for those who claim the earth and all life on it were created by mere chance and coincidence. I do want to disclaim, in view of my respect for science, that I realize these explanations approach scientific creationism theory and are unprovable by current legitimate scientific investigative methods. What I've written here doesn't need to be taught in school any more than any other theology-based explanations of creation. Good courses in scientific evolution, as it now stands, are what are needed in the public school curriculum, and I support those scientists who are laboring for that approach, Stephen Gould, for example, although he's passed on. I support them as long as their agenda is purely the teaching of science and not a subterfuge to undermine religion. As long as we have the freedom in this great land of ours to teach creationism, scientific creationism, or any other religious view of the cosmos in our homes, churches, synagogues, homeschools, and seminaries, that's good enough for me. Let kids get a good representative view of each in the temples and houses of knowledge of each and compare and choose for themselves. Astronomy professor and writer Jeffrey Bennett in Beyond UFOs, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Its Astonishing Implications for Our Future, previously cited, expresses much the same view. Like Darwin and countless other scientists, you are free to believe in your religion and evolution at the same time. You're even free to believe that none of it is true and that all the scientists who accept it are sadly misguided. But the fact is that these same scientists are using the theory of evolution to advance medicine, agriculture, ecology, and human knowledge of the biological universe. Whether you believe them or not, if you want your kids to grow up to be able to make similar contributions to our civilization, it is crucial that we teach evolution in school and teach it well. Page 81. Bennett gives this as a reason. Quote, America is falling behind in math and science education, and the poor state of education about evolution is a key reason why. After all, if we can't teach our children about the most important and unifying discovery in the history of biology, how can we expect them to learn science at all? Page 79. All I ask of my scientist friends is that they not endeavor to use evolution's teachings as a tool to undermine faith in God, the fall, and the need for an atonement. Leave that alone and you're fine with me. There is no need for hidden agendas. I do want to further muddy the waters with this observation. Evolution, if I understand correctly, depends totally on pure random mutations of genes. Contrarily, if I understand chaos theory correctly, there isn't really any such thing as randomness. Quote, in mathematics, chaos theory describes the behavior of certain dynamical systems, that is, systems whose state evolves with time that may exhibit dynamics that are highly sensitive to initial conditions. As a result of this sensitivity, the behavior of chaotic systems appears to be random, even though these systems are deterministic, meaning that their future dynamics are fully defined by the initial conditions with no random elements involved. End quote. Wikipedia, Chaos Theory. One might think chaos and biology are unrelated, but not according to James Gleick. In his book, Chaos, Making a New Science. Page 79, quote, within a few years, the study of chaos gave a strong impetus to theoretical biology, bringing biologists and physicists into scholarly partnerships. Molecular biologists began to see proteins as systems in motion. Physiologists look at organs not as static structures, but as complexes of oscillations, some regular and some irregular. This idea is continued on page 314. Quote, Scientists study evolution, hoping to find universal mechanisms of adaptation. Those who make such models quickly see structures that replicate themselves, compete, and evolve by natural selection. Evolution is chaos with feedback. Randomness with direction can produce surprising complexity. God plays dice with the universe, is Ford's answer to Einstein's famous question. But they're loaded dice, and the main objective of physics now is to find out by what rules were they loaded and how can we use them for our own ends. The point is, if there is no true randomness in evolution, but it is rather a system featuring chaos for its ends, intelligent design, in other words, then that puts the Creator back into the picture. He's just using mathematical principles we're only now beginning to observe and untangle. As I said in the beginning, God is just science we don't yet know. In Nibley's Approaching Zion, previously cited, I felt this takes place with these ideas. He quotes a 1937 Nobel Prize winner, Albert Szent-Györgyi, who states, quote, "According to present ideas, this change in nucleic acid, which determines the nature of protein molecules formed in a cell, is accomplished through random variation. If I were trying to pass a biology examination, I would vigorously support this theory. Yet in my mind, I have never been able to accept fully the idea that the adaptation and the harmonious building of those complex biological systems involving simultaneous changes in thousands of genes are the results of molecular accidents. The probability that all of these genes should have changed together through random variation is practically zero. I have always been seeking some higher organizing principle that is leading the living system toward improvement and adaptation. I know this is biological heresy. For example, I do not think that the extremely complex speech centers of the human brain was created by random mutations that happen to improve the chances of survival of individuals. I cannot accept the notion that this capacity arose through random alterations, relying on the survival of the fittest. I believe that some principle must have guided the development toward the kind of speech center that was needed." Page 203 through 204. To give some kind of balance to the other side, once again, Paul Davies previously cited, page 209, quote, "Religious adherents have learned to their cost how perilous it is to point to a phenomenon and say that is evidence of God's work, only to find that scientific advances subsequently provide a perfectly adequate explanation. To invoke God as a blanket explanation of the unexplained is to invite eventual falsification and to make God the friend of ignorance. If God is to be found, it must surely be through what we discover about the world, not what we fail to discover." To summarize this view, let me quote Carl Zimmer in his book Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, page 333. Quote, "Science cannot simply cede the unknown in nature to the divine. If it did, there would be no science at all. If the history of science shows us anything, it is that we get nowhere by labeling our ignorance God. Creation science in any form doesn't influence the way practicing scientists study the history of life." He goes on to show how paleontologists, developmental biologists, virologists, and others use the theory of evolution to push forward their work. For all of them, evolutionary biology, not creationism, remains the foundation of their work. Thus we conclude this 19th Part 2 podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Cosmos Part 3, and we'll deal with the 9th chapter, conclusion. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, HAZELLE PRODUCTIONS.com. Thank you.